all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. I'm not in the studio today, so I can't take your call, so we will re-air some recent discussions from the show. If you have a medical question about your children, you can email the show at any time at kids@mpbonline.org. I'm Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens. I'm not in the studio this morning, so we can't take phone calls. Instead, we'll re-air some conversations from previous shows. In this first segment, I talked to Dr. Griffin Metcalf about our kids and screen time. Dr. Metcalf is one of our MedPeds residents who's actually about to graduate, and he is going to be moving to New Albany, Mississippi, where he is going to be working as a MedPeds physician in that community. The things that they do for their senior, I think y'all call it the senior presentation?
Senior talk, right.
Senior talk, okay. For pediatrics, they have to pick a topic and give a discussion on it. And so his topic was screen time, which I thought was great, and I thought it would be a really good topic to discuss on the radio because we all deal with this. You can't avoid it now with your children. It's everywhere. And it's also the access to it. You know, I mean, when we were growing up, it was just a TV. That was really all you had. Now there's TVs, there's phones, there's tablets, there's computers, there's everywhere you go, there's screens. You can't even go to the doctor's office without having screens in front of you. So you can't avoid it. And so now we just have to learn how to use it for our good for our children. So I thought this would be such a good topic to talk about. How did you kind of decide to talk about this topic, and why is it important to you?
Yeah. So for senior talk, they typically ask us to present something that's relevant to your own life, interesting to you, but also helpful to a general pediatrician. And honestly, I had a hard time coming up with a topic, but in thinking about my wife and I, we have a 14-month-old boy, and probably a month ago, we were having a conversation about when the right time is to implement screen time and how to go about that appropriately and responsibly as parents. And so I thought I'd share that. And it's, you know, it's also something that I, you know, we routinely counsel parents on in the clinical setting, but it's something that I honestly had not done much research into myself and educating myself. And so it was really eye-opening and helpful to me, not only as a parent, but as a pediatrician. And I think it was semi-helpful to the residents, or at least I hope it was. But, and like you said, it's, you know, it's easy to talk about screen time and frame it as a negative thing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing. I think, like you mentioned, it's almost inescapable in our culture. If you think you're going to run from it, you're probably not going to successfully do that. But I think instead of trying to avoid it altogether, being intentional about stewarding it rightly and in a way that's helpful to your own children, I think is helpful.
Yeah. And it, like you said, it is okay for kids to watch TV. But we just need to, not even TV. I'm just so used to TV, but it's really not even TV as right. much anymore that they're watching. They're watching phones and tablets now. So it is okay, but let's figure out how we can do that to help them. So a little bit about like what the AAP says. So the AAP is the American Academy of Pediatrics. So they're kind of the guiding force, I guess, for pediatricians. And so what their actual stance is, they used to be just like hard, fast, nobody under two watch any screen time. They've kind of modified it a little bit, and they say 18 to 24 months, you could introduce it as long as it's high-quality programming, apps, and things like that. And then starting at 2, if you're going to use screen time, they really want you to limit it to about 1 hour per day. After that, I think it's somewhere around 6, maybe? I don't know the exact number, age. You may know it.
Yeah, so between... So above the age of 5, you can expand that to a couple of hours, but specifically, you know, above that, you can, because children get into school age and they start using screens for book reports and school assignments, and that does not count as the screen time.
Yeah. So 2 to 5, I guess, would be 1 hour a day. And then after 5, trying to limit it to about 2 to 3 hours a day, mm-hmm. if you can. Mm-hmm. And they say they want to make sure that, you know, even if you're doing the screen time, you want to make sure that, you know, your kid is still getting the adequate sleep that they need, which is 8 to 12 hours, depending on their age. They're making sure they're still getting their physical activity, which we can go over a little bit, too. And to make sure that they're having plenty of time away from the media as well. And we'll get into a little bit more of like how you can kind of balance that in a little bit, but just kind of wanted to throw out exactly what the AAP has to say about it. So if you're going to introduce screen time around age 2, can you tell a little bit about like what they recommend doing so that you can actually make it beneficial? So not just putting your kid down and giving them a screen.
Right. I think, so one of the things that makes screen time possibly a negative thing is that it can be isolating to children if you allow it to be. If you don't take it as an opportunity to point out things in the cartoon or the show or the video they're watching. And so some of the tips that I came across that I thought were really helpful is one, as you're watching, whether it be a cartoon, a video, any kind of show, is taking the opportunity to point out good behavior that's emulated in some of the characters, taking time to point out to your children references to either historical landmarks or things that could be educational to your child. And that sort of, you know, creates a community type atmosphere around screen time instead of just making it an isolated, a child by themselves interpreting the whatever they're viewing. Because I mean, the truth is children, they don't have they don't quite yet have the ability to interpret these things for themselves. And so I think, making sure that you're co-viewing it with them, mm-hmm. to show them these things.
And a lot of so my little girl loves Miss Rachel. We were talking about this, mm-hmm. before the show started. So I don't know if y'all have heard of Miss Rachel, but she's been on the Today. They've done little things under the Today Show and all the places like that have featured her. But essentially what Miss Rachel is a lady that just gets up in front of a green screen in her apartment, actually, is what she does, according to the Today Show interview. Which is crazy. It's her and her husband, and they just do like very simple, basic things, but they get your child to repeat things. They count. They really work on their language. So how Miss Rachel came about, which I think is really interesting. This is a little off topic, but I think it's very interesting. Her child had a significant speech delay, and she had a hard time getting him into therapy. And then even once he started therapy, you know, you only go once a week. And so to kind of reinforce some of the things that he was doing in therapy, she started creating these videos to help him. And so if you watch her, you know, if you've ever seen any of her videos, she like zooms in on her mouth and shows how to speak. And then she also like gets them to repeat the sounds and things like that. So anyway, just a little side story on Miss Rachel.
I did not know. That's interesting. Yeah. I knew that. So our son is 14 months. We haven't routinely implemented screen time, but there have been a few meltdowns in the doctor's offices that we pulled out Miss Rachel a few times, and it's been very helpful. Yeah. And she's a great example of so educational and so, mm-hmm. helpful.
When she asked you to repeat, so we watched it. My little girl's obsessed with Miss Rachel. She would watch Miss Rachel all day if we let her, but we do not. We only let her watch it in the car because she hates the car, or, you know, certain times when we're needing to get things done at the house. But But when we try to watch it with her, because she asks you to repeat a lot of things, and she likes you to point out colors, and it's not just Miss Rachel. There's lots of videos out there that do similar things. It's just this is the one that we use at our house. So what I try to do with her is I try to, like, say, all right, let's say it, you know, like, how did Miss Rachel say it, or that kind of stuff. And even when we're done watching Miss Rachel, like, so when Miss Rachel has a song about how to be gentle with your pets, and my 18-month-old is not always gentle with our pets. She loves to jump on the dog and ride the dog. And I'll say, Annie, what does Miss Rachel say we have to do? And she'll say, gentle. And so you can use things like that to your advantage. Like, mm-hmm. even when you're not just watching the show, you know, you can try to pull some of the stuff that they talk about in their videos and, like, get them to repeat it and point out good things, like you said, character behaviors and things like that while you're watching it. But you can also use it to your benefit when you're not watching it too. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, remember what did Miss Rachel say? Or what did we also watch some Mickey Mouse too? She loves Mickey Mouse. And so the clubhouse will say, what does Mickey say, you know, or what's the song? And you can kind of, like, use things like this to your advantage. So it's not always such a bad thing.
Right. And it's, you know, in clinic, when we refer children to speech therapy or physical therapy or occupational therapy, a lot of times what happens is they conduct a visit and then they give parents things they can do at home mm-hmm. to help their child develop. And it's a very similar concept. And just a practical way that you're almost doing a mini, you're implementing some of the mini therapy sessions at mm-hmm. home by using some of the tactics that you see
right.
that Miss Rachel and others
encourage. But the only way to be able to know how to continue to instill those things is to watch it with them, you know,
mm-hmm,
because
right.
if you just put them down and you're not actually engaging with them, then you're not using it for your benefit, you know.
Right.
If
yeah.
you don't know what your child is watching, how can you ever, what's the term I'm trying to use? Reinforce those, mm-hmm. you know, some of those learned behaviors that they're getting from watching these videos. So, again, you know, we always say it's so important to be involved in talking to your kids and have some open communication and know what's going on in your children's lives. And it's the same thing when you're doing this introducing screen time to your little ones. You want to make sure that you know what they're watching so that you can reinforce what they're watching or cut it off if mm-hmm. there's bad things. Like the other day, we were flipping through the channels and Cocomelon was on, and so I just stopped just to see, because, you know, they do that, and not saying Cocomelon is a bad thing at all, because I know they do some good things, but they were singing If You're Happy and You Know It, which was Annie loves the song, and we were singing and clapping, but then it was like If You're Angry, If You're Sad, and, like, it was just kind of showing all these different little things that I don't know that she really needs to be watching right now, especially mm-hmm. as we're starting our temper tantrums. We don't want her to start with the anger and things like that. So, you know, you got to be mindful of what your child's watching.
Right.
An older kid may be able to handle that a little bit better than, say, your 18-month-old. So
right.
just something to think about.
And then the other thing I would say is, you know, Miss Rachel's on YouTube. As you're viewing YouTube, we all know that advertisements are always popping up. And I don't know how this works, but they know that a child's in front of that screen somehow,
mm-hmm.
you know, the camera. And so advertisements sometimes geared towards certain age groups can pop up, and it may be things that they don't need to see. So just being able to censor that as well.
Yeah. You're listening to Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. I'm not in the studio this morning, so listen again to this discussion on GERD in babies. Reflux is very, very common, and it's actually a natural physiologic process that happens. So we have a little, what we call sphincter, but it's like a little valve at the end of our esophagus. So our esophagus is when we swallow what goes down our throat and it takes food into your stomach. And so you have a little valve there, the little sphincter there at the end of the esophagus that will squeeze off, and it prevents things from going back up into the esophagus from the stomach. So the food will travel down your esophagus into the stomach. That little valve will squeeze off and hopefully keep all the food into your stomach and not refluxing back up into your esophagus. But like I said, it's a normal process that some is going to come back up. You know, you're going to have a little bit of reflux. We all do. And most of the time, it's going to be very brief, not really going to cause any problems, and you may not even realize that it's happening. But there are some people, and like I said, very commonly, lots of people actually, that suffer from symptoms from this reflux. And so that's when we call it, the term that we use is GERD, or gastroesophageal reflux disease. You may have heard that term, GERD. But that's when it actually causes damage or to the esophagus or is causing symptoms. And so that's what we're really going to focus on today is, you know, what to do for the reflux and what to do when it's causing symptoms and causing problems. And when should you be concerned? Because like I said, it is a normal process and you can treat it supportively and with medications. But when should you be worried and when should you talk to your doctor about it or maybe even go and see a specialist about it? So reflux starts as early as 2 weeks of age. So a lot of our newborn babies, you'll see that even after 2 weeks of being home, that's one of the most common things that parents talk to me about at their two-week-old visit is they're spitting up so much. And what can we do about it? So it starts as early as 2 weeks of age. It peaks somewhere around the 4 to 5 months of age. And then usually by 1 year, most of our infants have outgrown it. And then we tend to see it again, especially we see it a fair amount in school-age children, not so much preschool, but definitely some of the school-age children, and a pretty good bit amount in our teenagers, and then tons of our adults, especially the older you get, we tend to see that more and more in our adults as well, in our older population. In our babies, the causes are going to be a little bit different than in our older children and our adults. In infants, the most common reason we see people spitting up and worsening reflux in our infants is going to be overfeeding. That's going to be the number one reason we see kids spitting up. And so that's one of the biggest things that we talk to parents about at that two-week-old visit when the babies are spitting up is trying to change the feeding. The other thing is, you know, if you've been around a newborn baby, you know they're kind of floppy. Things aren't very strong. Their muscles aren't very strong. A lot of things aren't really awake and strong in a newborn baby. So that little valve, that little sphincter that we were talking about at the end of the esophagus, it's not very strong. And so therefore, it can't squeeze down as good as it can in an adult. And so more and more that of those contents that are in the stomach are going to reflux back up into the esophagus. So very, very common for our newborns to have reflux. And all the way up until about probably 6 months of age, really, it's really common for our kids to continue to spit up. Now, as older kids and adults, most of the time, it's going to be related to what we're eating. What we're putting in our body, the food that we're eating. The other thing is being overweight. That does tend to make it worse. And then smoking, drinking, those are other big reasons too that can tend to make it worse. So kind of two different things that are going on with our babies versus our adults. And so that's what we're going to kind of break it down into how to treat that in babies versus how we treat that in older children and adults. So what are some of the symptoms that you'll see in our babies? Because, again, all babies spit up some, but how do we know if it's causing problems? So one of the first things that, as pediatricians, that we're looking for is, are they growing? Because that's one of the biggest things that we're looking at. You know, most babies are going to double their birth weight by the time they get to 5 months old and triple it by the time they're a year old. And so we're looking for that trend. So when you take your child to the doctor has probably shown you their growth chart, which is just a projection of how we should see the growth. It's not, you know, it's not just a straight up shot. It's a curved line. And so it's the way that we're projecting them to grow. And so that's one of the biggest things that we're looking for, especially in a baby that spits up a lot. Because if you've had a baby out there or a grandbaby, you know that sometimes you just can't believe so much can come out of that tiny little baby because they can spit up a lot. And so you want to make sure that they're able to keep enough of that down and getting enough of that nutrients that they're growing. Because if they're spitting up too much, then it can at some point affect their growth. Most of the time it does not, but that's one of the biggest things that we're looking for our infants. The other thing, it's kind of like just an older child and adult. Does it hurt? You know, if you've experienced heartburn out there, and I feel like probably everyone listening at some point has had at least one bout of heartburn, it's very uncomfortable. It's very painful. And even sometimes, you know, some people mistake it. Like, it can even be similar to the pain in a heart attack because it can be so severe, so significant. And so our babies can experience that sometimes. And so you'll see the babies that are really fussy, they get uncomfortable. They'll kind of arch their back up if it's hurting because that's just a more comfortable position for them to get in. And so we never want them to be uncomfortable and miserable. So that's the other thing to look for. So the biggest thing is if they're growing and then if they're being uncomfortable, if it's causing problems. And usually you'll see this is not, you know, you can kind of tell a difference between a colicky baby versus a reflux baby because, well, and sometimes it's walking a fine line. But a lot of times the colicky babies tend to get more fussy towards the end of the day. Whereas reflux babies, if it's the reflux that's causing them to be so fussy and uncomfortable, it's usually more of a timing after each and every feed. You can notice a pattern. So it's not just at the end of the day. It's with their morning bottles. And it's not immediately. It's probably somewhere between that 30 minute, you know, within 30 minutes to an hour after eating that you'll see them be fussy. And so those are some of the things to be looking for. If it's pretty significant, you know, sometimes you'll see babies that will refuse to eat because they know that it's going to make them uncomfortable. Every now and then you'll see them have respiratory problems too. Some babies get like recurrent wheezing or pneumonia, but that's usually not a very common thing, but that's definitely something to look for. And there's another thing that's called the Sandifer syndrome out there. And I don't know if y'all have ever heard of that, but it can be pretty scary even as a pediatrician and knowing what to look for. It's an interesting thing when you watch a child do it, but they have more of a neurologic response to it. So they'll reflux and they'll kind of arch their back and maybe even shake a little bit. It almost looks like seizure activity, and it can be kind of scary looking. And it's definitely something you want to go get checked out and rule out that it's seizures. But it definitely happens a decent amount with our bad reflux babies. So there's lots of different symptoms, but the biggest things, most common things that we're looking for is making sure that they're growing and making sure that they're not too fussy. So what can we do for our babies that are having problems with spitting up? A lot of times, just waiting it out. If they are not having the problems with growing and if they're not having the problems with being uncomfortable, which is going to be the most common thing, they're not going to really have any complications from it, then we just watch and wait. You know, that we call these babies, the term that we use are happy spitters. So they smile, they'll spit up, and then they just smile and laugh and just keep on going. And so usually what I tell parents in that situation is, you know, just take an extra set of clothes and a bib. And, you know, when you know that it's going to happen, and just keep on going. It's a very frustrating thing sometimes, but as long as it's not causing problems, we just try to wait it out. Because like I said, the biggest reason why the infants are having that problem is just because that little valve, that little sphincter down there is just not strong enough. And it gets better, just like everything on a baby gets stronger. That will get stronger, and therefore the reflux will get better. And also them just getting bigger. That also makes a big difference because babies, newborn babies, their stomachs are so, so tiny. And if we're giving them all of this breast milk, formula, whatever it may be that your baby's feeding, a lot of times the stomach just can't hold that amount of volume. And so it will, as they get bigger and as they get stronger, everything will get better. And so if you can, if you have a happy spitter out there, we tell you just to wait. And like I said, bring an extra change of clothes because it will get better with time. Some of the things that you can do, because like I said, it can be a very frustrating thing. Most of the reason, like we said, is overfeeding. So there are some things that you can do while you're feeding your baby that can be helpful. So when you're feeding your baby, especially breastfeeding, sometimes it's a little bit harder just because you don't necessarily want them to take breaks and take them off the breast because that can sometimes interfere with the latching process. But if you can, that is helpful. With a bottle, it's a little bit easier because you're able to see exactly how much you're giving your baby. And so say you fix a 2 ounce bottle or a 3 ounce bottle. At about every 1 to 1.5 ounces, make your baby take a little bit of a break. And the reason that is because, like I said, their stomach is very small. And what you're trying to do is to slow it down so that all of that content doesn't go straight into the stomach and overwhelm the stomach. And you're giving your baby breaks, which lets that milk pass through. If you can burp them during that time too, that also helps a lot. Again, just giving your baby time to get that milk moving through the stomach so it won't all come up at once. One of our old professors used to say that the baby's stomach is around the size of their fist. So if you think of a little baby's fist and trying to put 4 ounces in there, that's probably going to overwhelm the system. So what you want to do is slow that down. Some of our severe spit uppers, we have to even break that up even more. So if your baby normally takes 4 ounces every 3 hours, you may actually have to do 2 ounces about every hour and a half. So they're still getting the same amount to make sure that they're growing, but we're not overwhelming their system by giving that all at once.
This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. Since I'm not in the studio this morning, we are re-airing some discussions from recent programs. In this segment, I talk about headaches.
So I thought headaches would be a good topic to discuss, especially in this heat. I feel like a lot of people get headaches in this heat because one of the biggest triggers for headaches is dehydration. And living here in Mississippi and in the South, it is so hot and we have to drink extra water, more than we normally would drink, to keep ourselves hydrated with just the heat that we're experiencing. And so with that, a lot of people aren't able to do that and they're experiencing more headaches. Like I said, we see this all the time in clinic. We see it in kids. We see it in adults. And in our kids, sometimes it can be kind of hard. Like, is this truly a headache or are they just trying to get out of something? You know, that kind of thing. So a lot of times parents aren't really sure what they should do and what they should think about when their kids have a headache. So we're going to talk about that today. And as always, I would love to hear from you, so give us a call. Because headaches are one of these things that everybody kind of has their own little home remedy for that they found to be helpful. So if you can call and share those with us, we would love to hear from you. So like I said, everybody at some point has experienced a headache. If you have not, you're very blessed because we've all been there at some point. And some of the statistics said 90% of people are going to have a headache by the time they turn 18 years old. So that means at some point in raising your kids and raising your grandkids, they're going to complain about a headache. And then we know too, as we get older, so as we move from kids, adolescents, and into adulthood, the headaches only increase with age. So if you're an adult, even not raising kids, you know, you're still probably going to experience headaches as well. So hopefully this will be helpful for you. Before teenage years, it's pretty, you know, even boys versus girls. But as you get older, we typically do see more headaches in females. Particularly migraines probably has to do something with the hormonal changes, because we know menstrual migraines are a thing for women. And so it probably has something to do with hormones, but we do typically see more migraines in women. But that does not mean men cannot get them, because they definitely do. We just typically see it a little bit more in women. And then we tend to see it run in families. So a lot of times I'll have kids that come in, complain about headaches, and we're running through, you know, all my questions that I'm asking. And then I'm like, anybody in the family have migraines or headaches? And, you know, mom did, dad did. Somebody has migraines usually in the family if a kid is complaining about it. You can usually dig out a history and figure out somebody that did. So typically do run in families. Now, some of the just regular old tension headaches that we get, which can be very annoying. I hate to say just regular old tension headaches, because they can be pretty annoying as well. Those, not necessarily as much. I'm talking more like migraines and those kind of headache syndromes that we think about. So as doctors, when we're thinking about headaches, we're trying to determine if it's what we call a primary headache. Is it just like a normal headache condition, whether it be tension headaches, migraines? Those typically are our two most common ones. Or is it a secondary headache? And the secondary headache would mean that it's related to something else going on. So is it related to your blood pressure? Are you having high blood pressure, which is leading you to have headaches? You can have a condition called idiopathic intracranial hypertension or pseudotumor cerebri. You may have heard that term before, but essentially that's where you get an increased pressure in your brain behind your eyes, which can lead to headaches. Obviously we don't want to miss a brain tumor or anything like that that could be causing it. It could be your thyroid. I mean, there is a number of things that could potentially lead to headaches. And so as physicians, we have to ask you a bunch of questions so we can determine, is this what we call a primary headache and just a regular headache syndrome, or is this a secondary headache? Is there something else going on? And so that kind of leads me to my next thing is I feel like a lot of people don't know when they should come in for headaches, because we're talking about how common headaches are. But when should you actually come see the doctor? When is it considered a problem? And so a few things that we're going to want to know, and I would recommend if you do have headaches and you're considering going to the doctor, to try to start keeping a journal or a little diary of your symptoms, because that will be very helpful when you get to the doctor and talk about your headaches. So a few things that we are looking for, and is what we would consider red flag signs, I guess, is the term that we kind of always use. But those are ones that kind of trigger in our head when we're talking to the patients and they tell us some of these symptoms like, ooh, we need to think a little bit more about this, because these are some that could mean potentially, doesn't always mean, but could potentially mean something else is going on and it could be a little bit more serious. So if you're over, like, I would probably say 40, and you're just now getting headaches, you've never had headaches before in your life, and now you're 40 and all of a sudden you're starting to get headaches, that could be concerning, you know, because typically if you're going to have a headache syndrome, a lot of times it does start a little bit earlier. Doesn't always, but typically it does start a little bit earlier. So if you're kind of hitting that middle age area and you're just now starting to get headaches, that's probably a sign that you need to go talk to your doctor. Just get an exam, talk to them, and see what's going on. Some other symptoms would be if it's waking you up from your sleep. So headaches should not wake you up from sleep. So if you're asleep and you wake up in the middle of the night with a headache, that could be concerning. Or the other ones that we like to tell people to look for is early waking headaches. So like when you first wake up in the morning, you wake up with a headache. You know, that can be a sign of like something as simple as like a sleep apnea, or you just didn't get enough sleep at night. But it could be the sign of something else that could potentially be going on. So new onset headaches as you get older, waking up in the middle of the night with your headaches, or waking up early in the morning with your headaches, vomiting. And now I kind of give a caveat for this, because a lot of people out there listening that have migraines, you're probably like, well, I vomit with my migraines all the time, because that can be a potential side of like a symptom with migraines. This is more like vomiting without any kind of warning. So, you know, when you have migraines, if you've ever had one out there, you get that nauseated feeling and then you vomit. This is more of like vomiting without the nausea. And what we're looking for there is if you get significantly increased pressure in your brain, it will lead you to vomit. And so it's not like you're getting nauseated like you necessarily do with migraines. I mean, you could, but for the most part, with migraines, you're feeling nauseated. As opposed to like if you had increased pressure going on in your head, that necessarily wouldn't always make you feel nauseated and you would just vomit. So that's another big one to think about. I would say those are, and then they always give the caveat too of the worst headache of your life. You know, we've all had really bad headaches out there. But if you've ever talked to somebody who had like a significant headache where they actually was related to like a bleed in their brain, they call it a thunderclap headache, or just like the most painful headache you've ever had in your life. Many of these people can't even like open their eyes, think straight, because their head hurts so bad. And that can be concerning because those are going to be the ones that we think about with people who have like aneurysms in their head that may have ruptured and they have a bleed in their head. But like I said, this is going to be like a significantly severe headache, worst headache of your life. So those are going to be our biggest warning signs that we think about and our red flag signs. And that's going to, if you had any of these signs, that's probably going to prompt us to get some pictures of your head, because for the most part, we're not really going to get pictures of your head. But if you had any of these symptoms out there, you need to go get, you know, checked out so we can figure out what's going on. Some other things to think about just to tell the doctor would be, you know, one is how often you're getting them. That's very important when we're treating headaches, because if you don't get them that frequently, then a lot of times we can just kind of treat them as needed. But if you're getting them pretty frequently, then we may want to start you on like what we call a prophylactic medicine, or a medicine that would hopefully prevent and decrease the frequency of your headaches. So we need to know how often it's happening. We need to know where it hurts. So, you know, if you have consistently, you know, jot those symptoms down, because if it's consistently on the right side in the temple region, you know, we need to know that, because that could be indicative of what's going on and causing your headaches. So frequency, where it hurts, does it move anywhere else? What other symptoms are you having? Like I mentioned, migraines, you can get nausea. Also with migraines, you can get kind of like a warning sign, what we call an aura. So you kind of feel it coming on. You may see some changes in your vision or your hearing. And so we want to know about that as well. We want to know like what makes it worse, what makes it better. Again, because those kind of things can help us. A lot of times migraines get better with rest and in a dark room, but, you know, not always. So it's just things for us to know. And then you want to think about just like, have you been exposed to like any new medicines? Have you started a new diet, or are you working in a new location, and, you know, any of that kind of stuff? Because that could definitely play a role. Some of exposures and triggers that you have can definitely help us in treating your headaches as well. Oh, one other one I forgot to mention too, vision changes. And that kind of is one of those red flag ones. If you're having changes with your vision, that could be blurry vision, double vision, or just really any changes with your vision. That would also could be considered a red flag, and one that you want to make sure that you're going to see the doctor for.
You're listening to Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. I'm out of the studio this morning, so here's a recent conversation I had about diabetes medicines with Dr. Ha Phan.
Let's get into some of the newer diabetes medicines, which I feel like if you've watched any news channel over the past 3 to 4 months, you've probably heard the term Ozempic or Mounjaro, because a lot of people are using these now for weight loss, which they actually work really well. However, there's not truly an indication as of now, except for Ozempic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for Wegovy. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a little different. But a lot of people that have been using these medications that are not diabetics. Mm-hmm. So before we get into that, can you explain just how these medicines work? Because I think that a lot of people want to know, like, why are so many people wanting these medications? Because they are a safe medicine. They do help you lose weight, but they're technically a diabetes medication. So
yes.
Can you explain a little bit about how they work before we kind of get into some of the other indications for it?
Yeah, I think so. Starting out, so I think we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but the first or GLP-1 that hit the market, so that came out in 2010.
Okay. Yeah, I knew it was a while
around
ago.
Then. So that's been a while. So like you said, these are definitely safe medicines that have been studied for a while now. But I think the way that I explain it, and the easiest way probably to explain it, is that it makes you feel more full more quickly. Mm. So there's different hormones that our body like releases, but overall these are, it works on your gut peptides is what it says, but essentially what it does is that it makes you feel more full more quickly. So I think that's why it works so well when people are trying to use it for weight management, but ultimately it can also work on your glucose, and that's the main purpose of where it works and how it works downstream and all of that. So I think that's why people try to use it for weight management, but ultimately it works really well actually on blood sugars and glucoses. It can bring, I know we didn't define the terms, but if anyone's ever heard of like A1C or the measure of your sugar, your average sugar every 3 months, it can bring down your A1C like 1 to 2%, which is really awesome for a lot of our patients. So, yeah. So I guess
on average, a lot of the medicines will only bring it down like half to one.
Yeah, if that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty good numbers that it can bring it down 1% to 2%. So.
Yeah. And I always explain it as it's an added bonus that you get to lose weight. So when we are able to lose weight, that also helps bring down your sugar. So it's just you might get a little bit extra that you weren't meaning to get in terms of A1C lowering. But we'll probably throw around a lot of these names of the medications, but there are a couple ones that you've probably seen on the market. So there's Bydureon, which is like a little bit older. That's probably one of the first ones. And then you probably may have heard of Victoza, which a lot of us may have heard of. And then more of the more recent ones that are once weekly injectables are Trulicity and Ozempic. And then there's a new one, like Dr. McLeod said, that's on the market, Mounjaro, which is also once a week, but it's a little bit different than the other one. So how this one differs is when I said earlier that it's like acts in our like gut peptides and our hormones that way. This one works on two different ones, so that's how it gets like an added benefit. So it's still a GLP-1, but it has just a little extra to it. And that's, I think, what has helped a lot of patients in terms of the extra weight loss that they may be seeing when they're using that one.
This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. I'm not in the studio today, so I can't take your call. If you have a medical question about your children, you can email the show at any time at kids@mpbonline.org. So one thing I will say, too, is these medicines are for type 2 diabetics.
Yes.
So actually, our type 1 diabetics, these are not indicated for. So can you explain? I guess we should do a quick little explanation about the difference between type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is typically our younger patients. I mean, you can be in your early 20s and get diagnosed with type 1, but typically it's going to be our younger generation and our kids that are going to be diagnosed with type 1. It is considered an autoimmune process because what's happening is the body is destroying your pancreas, which is what makes the insulin. You have to have insulin to help your body absorb the sugars because they need the glucose and the sugar for energy. If you don't have insulin, then your body can't absorb that glucose and your glucose stays too high, which can then cause problems. So type 1 diabetics don't have any insulin because their body has attacked and destroyed the pancreas. It can't work anymore. Whereas type 2 diabetes is typically our older patients. It's our overweight patients. It runs really strongly in families. And so that's why a lot of times we kind of connect it with as you get older, there is a direct association with obesity as well. Because we know that if you lose weight, a lot of times you can treat the diabetes. And that is more of what we call like insulin resistance. So your body still makes the insulin. Your body just doesn't know how to utilize it very well. And then eventually the longer you have, and that's why the weight loss helps type 2 diabetes, because as you lose that fat tissue, you actually are better respond to the insulin if that's kind of an easy way to put it.
Yeah.
So that's why when we recommend weight loss for type 2 diabetics, because you can have some better response to the insulin because your body is still making the insulin. It's just not using it properly. Mm-hmm. The longer you have type 2 diabetes, the more your pancreas burns out because it's trying to produce that insulin for you to utilize it, but you're not using it correctly. Your body's not using it properly. So therefore, it eventually will die out. And that's why you do see some type 2 diabetic patients that have to be on insulin therapy. So just to kind of clarify that, because it's important because these GLP-1s really aren't indicated in type 1 diabetics. This is mostly type 2 diabetics. So I just kind of wanted to throw that out there so people knew that.
Yeah, we definitely have some patients that may have, you know, living with type 1 that are asking if they can use these. And unfortunately, right now, they're not indicated. Victoza is the main one that's usually once a day and taken every day. And I think the other thing I want to note is like the misconception that some people are worried that GLP-1s are insulin, and they're not. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an injectable medication is usually what we refer to them as. So they're not insulin. So like I said, Victoza is once a day. And then the other ones that we mentioned, so Ozempic, Trulicity, and Mounjaro, those are all once a week, which is another difference. And I think something else that we can bring up too is like, when should you not have these? So I think before we start someone on them, we always make sure that we ask like if they've had any history of something called pancreatitis or like inflammation of their pancreas, because when they studied these medicines, they saw that and when they injected them in mice, they saw that it could do that. That doesn't necessarily mean that it would happen or cause that to happen in adults or humans when we do inject it, but it's just something that they saw in mice and rats. So that is a precaution to make sure that we don't give it to, you know, patients that have a history of that. And then also if you have any kind of personal history of like thyroid cancer, they want to make sure that you also don't get it. Not to say that you'll get it if you're taking the injection, but they saw it in mice that it enlarged their thyroid cells. So not to say that it translates, they just want to be cautious.
Right. And I have had a patient, this was several years ago, probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, before we really had Ozempic and Trulicity, and she was on I think she was on Byetta, and which I don't even think is on the market anymore. But that was one of the first generations of these that we had. And anyway, she developed a thyroid nodule. It turned out it wasn't cancer. We got it biopsied, but we did end up stopping the medication just in case because of that that history with the – that's one of the things, is potential if you've had a personal history of thyroid cancer. So
yeah.
We've got a caller, so we are going to jump on the lines and go to Rachel, who's in Eupora. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning. So I'm wondering, is there an indirect or direct correlation between type 2 diabetes and pancreatic cancer? Or what about the medications? Can they start you down the path to pancreatic cancer?
I'm not aware of any connection between that. Pancreatic cancer, there's going to be more risk associated with like alcohol and smoking history than there is going to be type 2 diabetes. Now, there is, like Dr. Fan was saying, the risk of pancreatitis, which is inflammation in your pancreas. But I've never seen anything connected to it. I'm not sure if you have.
No, I haven't seen anything directly connected to it. But if someone does have a history of any of that, I wouldn't give them the medicines that we've been talking about, like the GLP-1s. But I haven't seen it cause that in patients living with diabetes or anything like that.
Thanks for listening to Southern Remedy Kids and Teens. I'm your host, Dr. Morgan McLeod. If you have a question about the health of your children, you can email the show at any time, kids@mpbonline.org.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.